Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is James Petras. Always lots to talk about when Jim comes on the program. Indeed so, Jim. I follow all of your articles. You and I seem to be coinciding on a number of topics. I'm not certain which one you'd like to jump into first, but I'm open to anything you want to discuss.
Well, Steve, I think with the elections coming up, the municipal elections in Venezuela, and some of the important exposés that you've made, I think it's important to start off with that at least, and then turn to other subjects like the negotiations between the Palestinians and Israel, the attempts by Iran to forge an agreement with the 5+1 countries. We can turn back to that if there's time at the end. But I first want to make some mention of what's going on in Venezuela. Basically, a context in which a government, first under President Chavez for about 12 years, is carrying out a very important New Deal for Venezuelans, essentially instituting a free universal free medical program, a free universal a higher education program, including the building of more than a score of new universities, the subsidy, food subsidies, and which provide low-income people with access to their basic commodities at very big discounts, and of course the raises in salary, minimum wage, the reduction of poverty, unemployment, and the opening up of some of the new opportunities for people through extension programs, educational programs, so that people that were on welfare or involved in very precarious life existences now have moved up the social ladder, have moved into newly built public housing at low rents. All of these programs, Steve, had a massive impact, and the government won 18 of 19 elections, or 17 of 18. The one coming up is the 19. And for that reason, the U.S. government took a very hostile position. He was an Afro-American president, now being was pursued and attacked and threatened by so-called Afro-American President Obama, and this was a shock, because when President Chavez extended a hand to Obama and said let's reconcile, let's come to some agreement to disagree, instead we got a vicious attack in the elections. Every time Chavez won an election, Obama would channel more resources to the opposition in attempting to destabilize the government. And look at the record. One coup, military coup, military business coup in April 2002, an executive-led lockout of the oil industry, which plunged the country into a major economic crisis, both of which were defeated. The first by a huge turnout of the populace, which reversed the coup in 24 hours with the aid of constitutional military people. Subsequently, we had the lockout defeated because most of the oil workers and some of middle management took over, and the government fired all the executives and their supporters among corrupt trade unionists, etc. And Chavez says, look, to Bush and subsequently Obama, I'm not going to support the war on terrorism, because that's a pretext to justify U.S. wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere. So he said, if there is a problem of terrorism, the problem is go to the social and economic sources and implement programs that recognize the sovereignty of people, and investing in social programs rather than in wars. And for that, he became enemy number one for the U.S. And then he went on and said, look, I don't have a beef with Iran. We're both oil-producing countries. We're both members of OPEC. I think it's justified to trade with every country. U.S. is our major market for oil, and also sharing technology and know-how with the Iranians. He opposed the war's invasion of Libya, destroying an African president. Again, Afro-American Obama smashing and destroying an African country. And he says the same about Syria. He says, I don't support the jihadists that are being funded from Saudi Arabia, nor the French or the Americans or the English. He says Syria should have its own government according to the lights of its own people, not by invading terrorists, and so on and on. And all of this led to this impasse, and now we have new elections, which I think should be the centerpiece of our discussion, and that's what you've done a marvelous job in outlining the various approaches which the U.S. has taken, none of them legitimate, and all of them in gross interference. They're funding business people that are inflating the prices of commodities, hoarding foodstuff, creating shortages in order to create popular discontent, to alienate the affection of the people for the new government of President Maduro. And the tactic reflects what was done in Chile in 1972 and 73. There they took over and financed the truckers' union that blocked the shipment of goods and commodities, created shortages, provoked inflation, and then they used that economic circumstances to generate a certain level of popular discontent, particularly among the middle class, that provided the basis for the CIA-sponsored military coup. And they're into the same thing. And there'll be a bloodbath if the U.S. succeeds. The 50 or 60% of the Venezuelan people will not sit on their hands when this thing gets engineered. It'll be hundreds of thousands of people fighting in the streets against any attempt to overthrow the government. And this is where Washington's policy is heading.
Oh, indeed, Jim. 1973, Chile, the other September 11th, 1973. Most people who even know about Chile back then don't realize it was on September 11th. And I remember the infamous Nixon line about making the Chilean economy scream, quote unquote. And exactly, Jim, the same thing is being done to Venezuela to cause these terrible disruptions, all manipulated, everything manipulated so that people will think the government is at fault. And you've got these December 8th municipal elections coming up. So to vote out the good guys and vote in the bad guys. And I mean, hopefully that won't happen, Jim. I haven't really followed any polling. I don't know just what the sentiment is, but I certainly hope the bad guys get really resoundingly defeated. We'll have to wait and see. But it really is a deplorable situation. I don't think it's going to stop. I think it's going to get worse. And it's possible Chavez believe that a number of times the Bush administration and Obama administration tried to kill him, and I believe that Obama ended up killing him, and Maduro has said that, and he has to fear for his own life. The last General Assembly session in New York in September, he didn't come. He was afraid there might be an attempt on his life. He stayed home. I mean, imagine that, Jim.
He went to China and signed a multi-billion dollar trade and investment agreement with the Chinese government. He's got agreements, investment in military supplies from Russia. He's developing strong ties with Brazil and Latin America. Of course, it's still the U.S. that's the big buyer of oil. But let's say this. What the U.S. has done through this hoarding, and it's not some claims or wild conspiracy theories, the National Guard of of Argentina has invaded a whole series of warehouses owned by the big supermarkets and found hundreds of tons of foodstuffs that don't go on the shelves. So the empty shelves, people go in, and then the opposition blames the government when in fact it's hoarding, sabotage by these companies. And the other tactic is jacking up the price. They get favorable exchange rate, the importers of the electronic stores, and the price of the a fair price with an adequate profit would be about 1,500 bolivars, and they're selling them for 6,000 bolivars. So that causes inflation. The huge markup in price has led to a close to 50% rate of inflation this year, which is undercutting the consumer power of working people, and they begin to get discontent. So what the government has done, finally, and taken a firm hand in this and says, look, you guys are distorting the market. You businessmen and bankers and supermarket owners are distorting the economy. And so what he's done is he's taken over large-scale chains of electrical stores, and they are selling the goods at a fair price. They have seized control of all the merchandise, and people are lining up at this price and buying the goods, and they're very satisfied because they've already cut inflation in those prices by 80 or 90%. And the same thing is happening with foodstuffs. They've raided a number of warehouses where they have tons of toilet paper, which is short, cooking oil, which is short, sugar, which was short, and they're finding more than enough to supply the demand. So they're in an economic war, and the U.S. government is supporting these people. They're subsidizing the organizations which are backing this hoarding, the NGOs, so-called non-government, which are largely funded by the National Endowment for Democracy, a front group for the White House. And he's taken a very aggressive stand. Furthermore, it's going to go deeper. Maduro has just secured decree powers from a two-thirds majority in the National Assembly, the legislative branch, that authorizes him to move directly through presidential decrees to intervene to prevent hoarding and corruption. There is corruption in the government, and the government has arrested 40 functionaries that supposedly is supporting the government, but were involved in connivance and complicity with the hoarders. And so the government is not only taking on the business, but also the corrupt officials who supposedly are partisans of the government. And that's a very positive step. He's impartial when he says, I'm fighting corruption and hoarding. That includes both the opposition people, the wealthy, but also the public officials who are involved in this kind of high crimes.
Oh, indeed, Jim. And this special power is called enabling power. It's an unusual law, but it's been in Venezuelan law. In the 1961 Constitution, it was in the law. Six presidents prior to... I don't know if it was six, but there were, I think, four presidents prior to Chavez used enabling law power, I believe, six times, and Chavez used it four times. This is the first time Maduro has asked for it. Chavez implemented wonderful things that further social justice and important initiatives that really help people. It was completely in accordance with the law. Venezuelans' new constitution, 1999, kept the law. It probably rewrote it a little bit from the 1961 version, but the idea really is to to get things, important things, especially when dealing with emergencies. And Venezuela, countries don't have them too often, but Venezuela at one point had a flood situation, and Chavez got legislation passed to get help very, very quickly to help victims, as opposed to what goes on in the Philippines, in America, where you've got these disasters and governments sit on their hands and do nothing. Really, governments simply don't give a damn whatever they do. Certainly America doesn't give a damn, and Venezuela does. It really is a model situation, Jim, and the long knives are out. Were out for Chavez. The long knives are out for Maduro and for Bolivarianism, which really is a name for social justice. And we can only hope, Jim, that they will absolutely fail. I remember the great angst I felt in 2002 when Chavez for 2 days was deposed, and the incredible street protests, and some of the, I guess, the middle-ranking people in the military, at least enough of them, really went to the wall and brought him back. And I think the opposition realized they made a mistake. They had a chance to get rid of him by killing him, and they didn't do it. They ended up doing it years later. But Chavez literally came back from the dead almost, and wonderful things happened while he was there. And one of the things I liked about him, and Maduro also, Jim, is I think there's a time for diplomacy and the rhetoric that goes with it, and there's a time for straight talk. And Chavez absolutely, in my opinion, was just a model of straight talk, and Maduro seems to be the same thing. If there's something wrong, and if Venezuela or if they or Bolivarian policies are being challenged, then they come right out and say and point fingers at who's responsible, and explain exactly what's going on in no uncertain terms, cut through the diplomatic rhetoric, and just lay it on the line so people understand that. And I must say, people were very upset at Chavez because of the way he spoke, and I absolutely loved it.
Well, Steve, I think what we can expect in these elections in December is that the opposition is going to do everything possible to sabotage the economic program. That's why the government needs special powers. We know there's been documentation that has been drawn together of actual meetings of the opposition in which they discuss how to plan sabotage, what kind of commodities they should take off the market, what kind of sabotage would have the greatest impact on voters in particular areas, particular low-income areas. So this is open warfare, and it has the complete backing of the U.S. When Maduro won the presidential elections in a very fair and honest election, including ex-president Jimmy Carter, said these are the most honest elections I've witnessed in a long time. The Obama regime refused to recognize it and incited the losing candidate from the opposition to contest them, to yell fraud, and to get out in the street. And the losing presidential candidate, Enrique Capriles, actually told his followers, quote, to express their anger in full. And they went out and killed 12 supporters of the winning candidate, President Maduro. So we can expect two things. We're going to expect the last week or so before the election, there's going to be probably blow up oil, electrical wiring to cause blackouts that affect whole sectors of the nation. They will heighten their illicit activity regarding hoarding. And after the elections, when they lose the elections, we can expect them to yell fraud again, to claim it was an illegal election, and to engage in more mayhem and chaos. So I don't think the electoral process is going to resolve what is essentially a low-intensity civil war. And what is striking about this, Steve, is that the Troika, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, and the New York Times discussed the government's policy, extraordinary powers. They discussed the fact that the government is intervening in these large retail outlets, but they don't say why. they don't take account of the fact that the government has shown on television huge hoards of goods that were hidden from the consumers. They don't show the price markups, which caused inflation. They don't talk about the manipulation of the currency exchanges in order to make up getting dollars cheap and then selling them on the black market. They don't discuss any of the real grievances and challenges that the government faced. All they kept label, the government is taking an authoritarian turn. Strongman Maduro imposes political intervention on the market. So the vast majority of the educated classes in the U.S. which read these newspapers get a totally distorted account of the most fabricated kind of reportage.
Oh, indeed, Jim, it is so utterly distorted. I've gone head-to-head with the U.S. media on Venezuela, as well as on a number of other topics, and I don't recall the specific title of one or two articles when I took on the New York Times, but the New York Times, and they had a former Caracas correspondent, Simon Romero. I think he's got a different venue now. Maybe it's Brazil or someplace else. But I went at Simon Romero a number of times, and I love to quote what they have to say, and then I add a fact check section to explain exactly what's going on, and just rip them apart. But the New York Times, you know, the so-called paper of record, all the news fit to print that isn't fit to read, and they go after an economy. no economy is perfect, Jim, but Venezuela compared to America. I remember an article I wrote about Venezuela that I called the two countries constitutional worlds apart. I compared what Venezuelans get under their constitution, and America's constitution says nothing about all these social benefits that are in article after article in Venezuela's constitution: healthcare, education, housing, subsidized credit, all kinds of wonderful things to help ordinary people most. And America's constitution, well, you know, America's elite wrote the constitution to benefit themselves, not ordinary Americans, and that certainly is the way it turned out.
Well, Steve, I think the polls are indicating the American people have grown enormously distrustful of the media, but particularly of the political institutions. The latest Gallup poll shows that 91% of the United States people, the public, has an unfavorable view of the Congress. That is 9% of the people have a positive view of the U.S. Congress.
An all-time low, Jim.
It's an all-time low, and it reflects on the fact that the Congress has a negative attitude to programs in countries like Venezuela. Instead, they pursue wars. They support Israel against a peace settlement in the dispute with the Palestinians. They're sabotaging the Iran negotiations and creating all sorts of obstacles. So the people are fed up. They don't want to have a so-called House of Representatives that doesn't represent anything that the American people stand for. In contrast, I'm absolutely certain that in Venezuela, the Bolivarian movement will get at least 50% of the vote, or very close to it, in the upcoming election. Now, contrast that with U.S. opinion toward its Congress. There's a tremendous gap here in terms of approval and legitimacy. The U.S. Congress doesn't have any legitimacy. How can you claim to represent the people when 91% of the people say you're doing a lousy job? You have been doing a lousy job, and we don't see any redress in the immediate future.
Well, absolutely, Jim. And the worst of it is, the Congress knows the polls better than anybody else, because every member of the House is up for re-election each 2 years. So the entire House, 435 members, have to go to the voters in November of 2014. Senators every 6 years. The senators up for re-election next year, they're very, very worried. They're the ones that are a little bit upset about Obamacare and other policies where they're getting all kinds of negative comments from their constituents and other things that they may not like, and the ones that have elected in last year, well, they've got a number of years, so they can go along with bad policies. But the policies are so bad, Jim, and they just continue that way. And even with a 9% approval rating for Congress, the same bad stuff keeps getting legislated. The laws stay the same. Ordinary people aren't helped. And when they talk about an improving economy, what's completely ignored is for ordinary people, we really have depression era levels of poverty and unemployment of over 23%, real unemployment, not the fake numbers put out by the Labor Department. Homelessness is high. Hunger is probably going to be greater than ever because food stamps were just cut, and there'll be more cuts ahead. So we spend unlimited amounts on war, Jim, and bailing out bankers and huge corporate subsidies and the rest of it. And for people who need enough food to eat, to feed their kids, to feed all the family members, Congress is cutting billions of dollars from this to further the other agenda. I mean, I'm surprised anybody approves of Congress, except the people who are benefiting by it.
Yes, I think you're right, Steve, and we're heading into a storm now with this latest round of peace negotiations coming up with Iran, and the Congress attempting to legislate more sanctions on Iran, which is directly related to efforts to scuttle the peace negotiations in the face of Iran making bending over backwards and making concessions with its clearly peaceful use of nuclear energy, and even allowing for the most intrusive surveillance, the reduction of enrichment of uranium, despite the fact that that's totally legal and within the bounds of the non-proliferation agreement. Where do you think that's going to go, Steve?
Oh, I am very negative on the outcome of this, Jim. I think longstanding U.S. plans since 1979, the Iranian Revolution, I think regime change is the core issue for America, and I consider the nuclear issue of Iran a completely legitimate program, as legitimate as anybody else's, where you've got a country like Israel that everybody knows they're nuclear armed and dangerous. They're not a non-proliferation treaty signatory. Israel is a nuclear outlaw. It has a formidable biological and chemical weapons stockpiled. All of this is well known. It's never discussed. Nobody talks about it. So Israel gets away with anything it wants to do. And Iran, with its legitimate program, I think these nuclear talks could go on forever. I don't think there'll ever be justice given Iran, because America, especially, and Israel, of course, and the European partners and the regional allies, they want the Iranian revolution overthrown. They want a puppet regime replacing it. It's the same thing. That's what the Syrian situation is all about. The situation was that way in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Libya. We've got to repeat it again in Iran. The thing I worry about is the possibility that there really could be a war against Iran at some point. It's not imminent by any means, but there could be a war, and that would be immensely dangerous. It could become a regional war, and it literally could go beyond that and become a global war, and that's scary, Jim. It's very scary.
Yes, in terms of lives lost, if Israel and the U.S. launch missiles into the cities of Iran, there's over 75 million Iranians that be in danger. And let's think about the impact on oil prices and energy prices. The Iranians are not going to sit on their hands. They'll shoot at the U.S. bases in Saudi Arabia. They'll shoot at offshore ships. They'll put long-scale missiles into operation. They may attack the oil wells in Saudi Arabia and push oil prices to triple what they are today. So if we're paying $3.60 a gallon, it'd probably go up to over $10 a gallon. And this is what is at stake in the recklessness with which Kerry and especially Netanyahu, who say that war is the only answer, they're threatening our very existence.
They really are. They absolutely are. And if they go after Iran, Jim, with these so-called bunker buster bombs to get at the underground facility, there's an underground facility at one location of Iran, to get at it, it's possible they would use nuclearized bunker buster bombs. We're talking about a nuclear war, Jim. I mean, what kind of crazy leaders would consider doing something like this? And there could be retaliation. Imagine if Iran retaliates and hits Israel's nuclear sites and U.S. Sites and blocks the Strait of Hormuz. I mean, we could really, World War III would be the worst calamity of all. But all of these things could be potentially catastrophic. And leaders aren't responsible enough to think that this is possible and to
especially
take every measure,
Steve,
to prevent
with
it.
The new leadership in Iran, which has shown itself eminently reasonable, has dropped any bellicose rhetoric, looks forward to signing off on agreements that would open oil fields for U.S. investors for joint ventures. They have, in the past, offered to cooperate in fighting terrorism, especially al-Qaeda people. They've jailed al-Qaeda people in Tehran. So it's a win-win situation if the warmongers can be held in bay.
Absolutely. We're out of time. I've got to cut you off. Oh, we could go on and continue with this. We will when you come back next month. Jim, many, many thanks.
Okay. Thank you very much, Steve, and keep up the superb exposé.
Oh, thank you, Jim. Thank you so much.
All right, bye.
Reminder to my listeners, join us tomorrow and Sunday, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.